It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. The 9-to-5 crime wave, costing businesses $50 billion a year, isn't about burglary. It's employee theft. From paper clips to laptops, employee theft is one of the fastest growing crimes in the United States. Why do we steal from work, and what can be done about it? Have you ever stolen anything from your office? Do you think items such as pens and pencils should be fair game in the office to take home? Where do you think we should draw the line? Are you an employer? How has your company ever dealt with internal theft, and what did you do about it? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, email ideas@wpr.org. Ryan Sanchez joins us this morning. He's a former loss prevention leader at Shopko. Ryan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, John, how you doing?
You've said that employee theft at work is getting worse. Why is that?
Well, there's a few reasons, in my opinion. One of the major ones is the hiring process. For instance, there was a manager that was hired, and within 3 months he had broken the forklift, and that was a loss of $15,000. Obviously, that's not a theft, but it still goes, against the budget, and it's essentially shrink, which is a loss to the business. So hiring better people, more qualified people, is one of the major things that I would recommend. There's also moral and ethical erosion of religious beliefs, I think. And quoting from religiousnews.com, fewer Americans that are aged 18 to 29 have no religious affiliation, and that has nearly quadrupled in the last 30 years, and I imagine that's only going to get worse. So those are a few of the reasons, or a couple of the reasons why I think it is getting worse.
I guess I came into the radio business at a time when the common joke was less than minimum wage and all the records you can steal. This isn't anything new. I mean, employee theft isn't any – this isn't something new. What is it – what's different now?
Well, it's easier to get away with. For instance, at Shopko, all of the stores are closed or closing. So they're going to have less people on the sales floor, which means there's less coverage, which means there's less of a deterrence for employees to steal, essentially. When you have more staff on the sales floor, they're not going to have the same opportunities. And because of that, it's a lot easier to steal. All you need really is two elements. You need the opportunity, and then you have to have the rationalization behind it. Like, how can I get away with stealing this?
Are certain businesses more prone than others to have employee theft?
As you were saying, it's been happening forever. I don't think one's necessarily more prone than the next. I mean, every single retail store I've seen has decent measures. Walmart, Shopko, they all have loss prevention staff. I would say if your store doesn't have an adequate camera system or people that are monitoring the situation via either camera or floor walking, then yeah, those are probably the most susceptible.
How is this theft happening? You mentioned sort of the shoplifting, just taking stuff off the shelves, but are there other ways that employees are stealing?
That's the number one way is to just walk out the front door with the item that you have. There's different ways to do it, backpacks, purses. It's usually not like the person just has the item in their hand and then they walk out, right? They have to conceal it. But there's more to shrink than theft, and that also deals with employees, right? So I mentioned the forklift thing before. There are a lot of costs to businesses, and when you combine everything, it really becomes a perfect storm for companies like Shopko to lose their business. It's just huge amounts of losses.
What about things like return fraud?
That happens a lot too, and that is where training comes into play. You really have to have your service desk, the ones that are doing the returns, do a thorough job checking the items, making sure that people aren't returning old items, and making sure everything's on the up and up. No, you know, no matter what happens, you're going to have return fraud, unfortunately.
But the fraud would be on the part of the customer returning something that they had no business returning.
Correct.
In this case, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So let's say I buy a like a cell phone case, and I already had a cell phone case of the same variety, the exact same one. And, you know, I go to Best Buy, and I decide to pick up the same case, and I throw my old case inside of that one, making it look like new, and then I go up and try and return it.
Mm.
That would be a pretty good example of
Let's take a call here. Sarah is with us in Lake Geneva. Sarah, welcome to the morning show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Your guest had mentioned the lack of religion as a cause for demoralization and workplace theft, and he cited a religious site for that. I'm just curious what other evidence he has stating that religion is the basis of our morals, and how that, by hiring religious people, essentially, that would decrease workplace fraud.
Well, it's not just religious. It's also parenting, I believe, how you are grown up. When I was a kid, I was taught not to steal. Are parents nowadays hammering that in their head? Are they saying stealing's bad, theft is wrong, and I shouldn't do this because it's not right? It's not just religion. It's just a component of it, in my opinion.
What do you think about items like pens and pencils and paper clips? Are they fair game? Where do we draw the line of what employees can and can't take?
Well, I think they start out small. Pens and pencils might be one of the items, but a national list that I have here says razors, infant formula, designer handbags, laundry detergent, cigarettes, high-end liquor, and jewelry are the most common stolen items from February 2018, according to the National Retail Federation. I have my own store's items that I thought were the most stolen, and they were DVDs, comics, clothes, jewelry, candy, energy drinks, medicine, and health items. I find that people usually graduate from food or candy or energy drinks, and then they start stealing the higher end things, the DVDs, the clothes, the jewelry.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes is theft motivated by somebody who feels underappreciated, or they don't think they're making enough money, and so they feel like they're just getting their due from their employer?
I would say that's definitely true. When you hire someone at minimum wage, maybe in their brain, they aren't getting a fair shake. And to get that fair shake, maybe they are stealing for that reason.
We're talking about theft in the workplace with Ryan Sanchez. He is a former loss prevention leader at Shopko. Have you ever debated stealing something from work? If you decided not to, why did you change your mind? Were you afraid you were going to get caught? And what did you think would happen if you got caught? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@WPR.org. Weigh in on our conversation about employee theft. It's $50 billion worth of shrink to the American retail industry, which is, industry, and not just retail, but everywhere, represents a pretty big number. What do you think about it? 800-642-1234. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. We'll be right back. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. Employee theft is one of the fastest growing crime categories in the U.S. $50 billion going right out the back door every year. We're discussing why this is happening and what can be done about it. Do you work at a company that has surveillance cameras? How do you feel about it? Do you find it's necessary to monitor theft, or do you think it's an invasion of privacy? Have you ever seen a coworker steal an item from work? What did they take, and did you report it? Why or why not? Do you work in security or loss and prevention? Do you see a lot of employee theft? What items are the most popular to steal? We're talking about this with Ryan Sanchez, former loss prevention leader at Shopko. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Michael is with us in Milwaukee. Michael, you're on the morning show. Go ahead.
Hi. I've worked in an office environment for, 30 years at various manufacturing businesses. I did work in the service industry and retail many years ago. And I've not seen, a great deal of employee theft. I mean, we had some people stealing wallets and purses, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and that was an isolated incident. But I don't see people just, at least in the office environment, trying to steal any way they can, anytime they can. In retail it may be different, but office environment, I've just not seen any uptick or any problem with it, frankly.
All right, Michael, thanks so much for your call. Let's go right to Cheryl in La Crosse next. Cheryl, good morning. Welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Say, I just wanted to note that I used to work at a Shopko many, many years ago, back when things were priced. The checkout girls used the price sticker as opposed to barcodes. And the Shopko I worked at had a manager who was fired for pricing things on clearance that weren't and then purchasing them herself. And I know things are a little bit different now with barcodes, but I do still think with certain levels of management and supervisors having override capabilities, that certainly is a potential place for theft.
Cheryl, thanks so much for that. What do you think, what are the some ways that employers can prevent theft like this in the workplace?
Well, a manager should be the first priority on hiring adequately, making sure that doesn't happen. I have seen that myself even, so Cheryl is correct. There are some price switches. I've seen that more on the customer end, though, and not the employee end. Not to say it doesn't happen, but definitely more prevalent with customers from my store.
What about what Michael had to say? He's not seeing any kind of theft where he is. I'm just going to make a wild guess here. Retail is the most vulnerable. It can happen elsewhere. There are some businesses that are probably not likely to see much theft at all, wouldn't you say?
It might be harder to get away with stealing in an office environment as well. I'm not sure which office he worked at, but, if it's computers or something, it's much harder to take a computer out the door than it is a purse. He did mention a purse. That's probably more employees stealing from employees.
Right.
And that's a little bit more rare.
And most of us have had our lunches stolen at one time or another. A technical question here. If I pick something up in a retail store and I try to just walk out with it, an alarm sounds, unless it's been scanned and the process goes through the process of having the whatever signal that was built into it removed or muted. I don't know exactly how that works. But how then is an employee going to get something out the front door of the store without making the alarm go off?
Well, what you're referring to is an EAS tag, electronic monitoring system, and those systems can be taken off by employees. At the store that I worked at, the electronics manager had a EAS remover. It's a key fob, and every cashier has one. And if you have a friend that just wants to take it off and you're buddy-buddy with them, then the alarms won't go off. And not everything has one of those tags. We prioritize things that are small that have high value. Fragrances, video games, Blu-rays, televisions, things like that. So if you just walk up with a piece of candy and walk out, there ain't no alarm that's going to go off.
What about you said that you once tested having hidden cameras look over the food aisles at a Shopko? You were checking to see if employees stole food. What did you find out?
Well, I noticed a lot of wrappers, and when I say a lot, I mean a lot, like bags that were just opened, and someone was very hungry. So I decided to overnight put in a camera above it, a hidden camera, and that camera alone, I caught four people stealing, and all four of them were fired. And I actually had more of them, but there was a $10 limit at the store that I worked at, so you had to steal $10 before you were basically fired.
Are stores hiring and training the right employees for the job, or can work thieves be anyone?
Well, I think, like I told you before, the hiring process is very important. But to your question, yeah, I mean, anybody has the potential to steal.
Well, when you catch somebody in the act of stealing or afterward, what do they say is their reason for taking something?
Times are rough at home. I thought I would only do it once, but then it became addicting. A lot of people have a sob story as to why they are taking the items, but it's usually they're not paid enough, or they weren't treated well by the whole management staff as a whole, or they were leaving soon and they thought they could get away with it, things like that.
Mm-hmm. What should employers do if they find one of their employees is stealing at work? Is theft an automatically fireable offense in every case?
I believe so. You are untrustworthy, and if you're stealing from your employer, what else are you doing? Are you skimming the clock? Are you taking lunches that are an hour long? You know, mistakes happen, but when it comes to theft and all that, there really shouldn't be any second chances.
Kristen from Madison couldn't stay with us, but she asked if people are stealing things out of necessity, like baby formula, could higher wages help reduce workplace theft?
It could, and baby formula actually is on the national list for top stolen items, so she's right. There are some items stolen out of necessity, that is for sure. I'm not 100% sure if, you know, like $12 an hour for a seasonal employee is going to fix that. It could. I guess we'd have to see. I'm not sure that they could afford to pay a seasonal employee $12 an hour either.
Mm-hmm. Well, when someone steals from their place of work, how does this impact a company financially?
Significantly. So that forklift that I told you about was $15,000. And there's probably at the store that I worked at, I mean, the one that I worked at already wasn't making a profit. So that means that through the course of sales, we are not creating a profit. So anything that's stolen just makes that line go down even more. And the shrink becomes unbelievable. And that's part of the reason why that store was closed first.
The forklift incidents, was the manager trying to steal the forklift or just didn't know how to run it?
He just did not know how to run it correctly.
Shouldn't have been on it.
And he's the one that was certifying other people to use the forklift.
Uh-oh. That's not good.
You can imagine how that might spiral out of control.
Yeah, let's quickly take a call from Karen in Weyerhaeuser. Karen, good morning.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to share a story that helps to kind of support some of the information your guest has shared. I was a manager for a large Midwest farm and home store for almost 20 years, and we had an employee that was very dear friends with the owner, the big owner, and come to find out after 30 years of service, for 30 years she had been towel and toilet paper and anything else she could fit in her lunch pail every day. And who would suspect her lunch pail? It was oblong. She could fit paper towel, et cetera, in it. And she was quietly fired. And people would say, well, what does it matter? It's just a roll of paper towel. But you have to think about that over the course of a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
That's an awful lot of money, and it comes to the person's integrity, as to your guest is saying, what else might be happening?
It
was a bad situation.
Little things add up. Karen, thanks for the call. So, Ryan, what are some ways that employers can prevent theft in the workplace?
Hire competent LP. I mean, just like anybody else, you can have LP or loss prevention that are lazy or not very good at their job. The camera system has to be adequate. So if you put a camera in a place, like for instance, the camera you talked about, the snack one, before that was there, I had no coverage. I had no idea what was going on. All I knew is that things were being stolen. So you do have to have adequate camera placement. And I would encourage management participation to do the same types of jobs as the employees do. I'm not saying they should do it every day, but it kind of builds that camaraderie. It kind of builds a level of trust and empathy. And if they're around and they're having a decent time while they're working and you create a good work environment, I do believe that will decrease theft.
Okay. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much.
Ryan Sanchez is a former loss prevention leader at Shopko. Coming up next, the news. Then, U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin joins Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll discuss what's happening in Washington and how that impacts us here in Wisconsin. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin is here with us to discuss tariffs, health care, the Equality Act, and other news from Washington. What are your questions for Senator Baldwin? What are your biggest concerns? What do you think politicians in Washington need to know about Wisconsin in this moment? Are you worried about health care, the environment, the economy, immigration? What are your thoughts? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org is our email address. Tammy Baldwin is a U.S. Senator who has represented Wisconsin since 2013. Good morning, Senator, and welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. It's great to join you.
President Trump recently threatened tariffs against Mexico and then backed off, announcing that he had reached an agreement with Mexico to reduce border crossings. What's your take on the president's use of tariffs with Mexico and other countries?
Well, I'd start with the tariffs that have been in effect for quite some time now on steel and aluminum. I am not opposed to tariffs in all cases, and I think they were appropriately addressed to China, where we see state-owned enterprises competing on an unlevel playing field against our domestic manufacturers. But I still see no evidence as to why the Trump administration applied those tariffs to Canada, to Mexico, and to the European Union. And we know that they resulted in retaliatory tariffs against Wisconsin products like cheese, ginseng, cranberries, other things that we are known for producing. The continued rhetoric back and forth with threats of additional tariffs for different reasons have only made matters worse, and particularly in our dairy industry, where at this point in time we're losing on average 2 dairy farms per day in our state. It is just something that is really exacerbating a very difficult agricultural economy, as well as we have a robust manufacturing economy that it is impacting also. But getting up to the recent weeks of disputes back and forth, at the end of that back and forth, when President Trump announced that some deal had been reached, he talked about it in very vague terms, alluding to a deal with regard to border crossings. But he also made an announcement that none of us anticipated, which was that Mexico had agreed to immediate purchases of agricultural products. He gave no details, and when asked as a follow-up, his Department of Agriculture representatives could verify no deal, and the foreign minister of Mexico also said he had no idea what the president was talking about. And with our farmers hanging in the lurch, I wrote to the administration and said, we need to know what's happening. There's a lot of speculation that this was complete fabrication, that no such immediate deal about agricultural exports to Mexico had been reached.
Hey, looking at the president's trade policy as a whole, is there any benefit to Wisconsin from what President Trump has done in this area?
Well, first of all, I can't put every challenge that's facing our ag community at the administration's feet, but frankly, any action that exacerbates an already difficult situation needs to be scrutinized. Dairy farmers in particular, and of course Wisconsin is America's dairy land, dairy farmers have faced low prices for the milk produced for a number of years now. Usually we see ups and downs that our dairy farmers can withstand, but we've seen low prices for now a very long period of time. There's oversupply issues, and then when you add onto that horrible weather and these retaliatory tariffs against our number one dairy product, which is cheese. Most of the milk we produce in Wisconsin goes ultimately into cheese. It just exacerbates a really, really difficult situation. And it seems like the Trump administration, you know, they'll announce some sort of relief program. But the farmers I've been talking to have seen very little relief at all. And we continue to lose farms at an alarming rate. 1,500, over 1,500 farms have closed operations since President Trump took office.
Tammy Baldwin is a United States senator who's represented Wisconsin since 2013, and she's in on the air with us this morning. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for the senator. Senator Baldwin, earlier this year, you urged an investigation into how the Wisconsin National Guard handles sexual assault cases after soldiers and constituents brought up complaints on the morning show. We've spoken with the National Guard and with a soldier about this. Are you satisfied with how the investigation has been proceeding?
Well, the National Guard Bureau contacted by me and the governor because it appeared that we needed a comprehensive assessment, top to bottom, bottom to top, to look at all the open and closed sexual harassment and sexual assault investigations. When that was initiated, I know I was informed that this was going to be very comprehensive and would result in a report that goes into, again, their comprehensive look. And I anticipate that. It's an ongoing investigation, and I expect them to produce a report that will be made public and that it should be both independent and comprehensive. Previously, there had been some other smaller inquiries, and we believe that the Office of Complex Investigations at the National Guard Bureau needed to come in and handle this.
Let's take a call. Clint is joining us from Sun Prairie. Clint, good morning.
Good morning. Say, I just wanted to talk about the immigration kind of issue that we're talking about as the border and building a wall. I believe under the Obama administration, there was policies put in place where we were doing funding to Central American countries where they could provide resources and safety for people to stay down in Central America. And I'm wondering why that doesn't get more press or put out as an option to the American people to understand that that was a really cost-efficient policy, along with very effective for people so they could stay in their homeland. So I just would like to hear the senator's thoughts on that.
Thank you very much, Clint. Senator Baldwin?
Well, there are ongoing discussions, certainly on Capitol Hill, regarding support through the State Department on various types of aid to three countries in Central America predominantly, Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. In those countries, there's specific and unique problems in each country, but a situation where gangs have overtaken many communities. Violence is very commonplace. And in one of those countries, they're having an agricultural crisis due to, I believe, drought that is leading some to face starvation as their critical issue. We were very concerned. I speak for myself and some of my colleagues when the Trump administration threatened as punishment to withdraw the sort of aid that's channeled through the State Department from those three countries, because our view is it would make the situation there even worse and probably result in even more people fleeing violence, fleeing a situation where there's not adequate food and nourishment to come to ultimately our southern border, where there is clearly a humanitarian crisis. I will say that just yesterday, the Senate Appropriations Committee passed an emergency spending bill to deal with some of the humanitarian issues at the border, and we're going to continue to monitor this situation as robustly as we can. But there are some very alarming things going on, including a private for-profit corporation that has been given a no-bid contract to house migrants at the border. Every report we get is that there's extremely crowded conditions, unsafe conditions, unsanitary conditions, and that's certainly not acceptable.
We've got about a minute left, Senator. You're the first openly LGBTQ U.S. senator, and you're pushing for the Senate to pass the Equality Act, which the House approved last month. This legislation would ban discrimination against LGBTQ people. Why is this law necessary in addition to existing civil rights protections?
Well, it's just wrong that in a majority of states in the U.S., people are not fully protected from being fired or evicted from their home or denied services because of who they are or who they love. And it's really time to end this discrimination, and the Equality Act would do just that. Not every American lives in a state or a city or a community that has protective policies that allow people to fight back, and we know that discrimination sadly still exists. So after the House took an historic step, we believe the Senate should act also to pass the Equality Act. And this Pride Month that we're celebrating during the month of June, 50th anniversary of the Stonewall riots, we think it's high time to happen.
All right, Senator, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tammy Baldwin, U.S. Senator who's represented Wisconsin since 2013. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. The Wisconsin State Assembly passed a bill this week that would regulate the implementation of 5G wireless networks in Wisconsin. The bill was passed by the Senate and now heads to the governor's desk. We explain 5G and consider how it could impact broadband access in Wisconsin, particularly rural Wisconsin. Do you have problems with the internet in your part of the state? How has that affected your life? How could better internet access change your life? Have you used a 5G network before? What was that like? Do you think having access to 5G across Wisconsin would be beneficial, or do you think it's not worth the time and money to implement it across the state? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. I have to say that I was in the Twin Cities this past weekend where there is 5G, and I just thought it was totally amazing. Tom Still is president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. Tom, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you, John. Glad to be here.
First of all, let's explain, what is 5G and how is it different from what we have now?
Sure. Well, 5G is essentially a technology, a wireless communications technology platform. And as you might imagine, the G stands for generation, meaning this is sort of the fifth generation. It began with 1G, which was analog back in the 80s. Nobody uses that anymore. Then 2G, 3G, 4G, and now LTE is one of the latest systems. And those were really good steps. I mean, amazing things happened over the last 30 years or so. But this 5G is really going to geometrically increase how we use wireless, both in speeds, data, the penetration, the amount of distance it can carry if you have the right network. So really revolutionary.
Now, what would it take to implement 5G in Wisconsin? What kind of infrastructure do we need to build?
It's going to start, I think, with largely what's called small cell technologies, meaning not the big, at least at first, not the big towers that many people have grown accustomed to seeing, although those can be adapted in time. But I think it's going to start largely in cities where there's enough density. And these small cell technologies will look like, small kind of packages or platforms on utility poles that will be around. And they can be mounted on a variety of existing things as well. So that's part of the infrastructure, is to have those transmission sort of stations spaced out at the right intervals, which really dramatically increases how much it can be used.
The bill that is headed to Governor Evers' desk would limit regulation of 5G technology, including preventing local governments from charging fees on 5G infrastructure. Do you think that kind of limited regulation is a positive thing, or should localities have more say?
Well, I think it is a positive thing. Let's just look at cable and the cable industry over time. Municipalities and villages were able to charge fees, and guess what? How much innovation have we seen in cable over time? It's really time to make sure that a system is truly going to be statewide and put in place in a way that has limited roadblocks. I think there's still a lot in there that municipalities can choose to do in terms of how they regulate. But at the end of the day, this is what's happened in other states. You mentioned at the outset being in the Twin Cities. Minnesota is a state that has made sure that the barriers to entry are low enough that you can justify the investment in this. And it's the same with every state around us. We're almost the hole in the donut right now, until hopefully the governor signs this bill.
Tom Still is president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. Tom, do you think, is 5G the answer for lack of broadband access in rural Wisconsin?
I'd have to say not immediately, because of how it will be rolled out and the investment that will be required over time. I think it will help, and especially as it's adapted for use with existing towers. But at first, I think because of the investment costs, the density, it's probably going to start first in more urbanized areas and then move out. I think there are other great things happening around broadband in rural Wisconsin, which is good. And there are existing systems such as 4G and LTE, which are still, being implemented in those areas. All an improvement. But over time, I think this will help rural Wisconsin get better connected in everything from e-commerce to healthcare to municipalities themselves.
Supporters of the bill that we referenced earlier are calling for 5G implementation before the Democratic National Convention in Milwaukee next year. Is that feasible?
I think that's a natural starting place for downtown Milwaukee and of course the density that you find around the Fiserv Forum and all the other sites that'll be part of DNC, which of course is going to kind of be dominating the cityscape there for a while. I think that the technology is ready. I think some of the carriers are ready to get it going, And so it is feasible. I do not have access or know the exact schedule and how much they want to, you know, how quickly they feel they can roll it out. But from a technical standpoint, it's feasible.
What have we seen in the places that have already begun to implement 5G?
5G is really going to change a lot of different sectors of our economy and our lives. It's going to do things like really power the Internet of Things, which means, you know, the interconnected nature of what's going on in industry and logistics and everything else. You'll see it. I think healthcare is going to be a major beneficiary of this because providers will be able to get real-time information about patients, especially in rural settings, and be able to move more quickly on either diagnosis and or treat. You're going to see it touch energy grids, I think, smart cities, things like traffic signals, emergency services. You'll see it touch cybersecurity. I think it's going to be pretty ubiquitous in terms of how it affects the economy overall. Mm-hmm. Because, again, this is a geometric progression. This is not sort of incremental as such as some of the past wireless communication systems have been.
Matt from Wisconsin shared over email that he thinks this problem should have been solved sooner. What's been stopping the state from adopting 5G earlier?
Well, I think perhaps the time wasn't right for how it was playing out in the eyes of municipalities and others who worried that they might forfeit too much control. And so I think that was probably at the heart of it. I don't think that it was about technology whatsoever, because other states have moved ahead. You can draw a ring around the upper Midwest, and we were that hole in the middle. So I think that it's ready, and perhaps we'll have, as a result of that debate, a stronger infrastructure and stronger public acceptance.
All right. Tom, thank you so much for joining us on the Ideas Network again. Always appreciate hearing from you.
Oh, thank you, John. Pleasure to be on air.
Tom Steele is the president of the Wisconsin Technology Council. Just ahead, we're going to have a conversation with the new leader of the Wisconsin Democratic Party about the organization's priorities, including the state budget and the upcoming presidential election, and we'll find out why some television stations have returned to playing the national anthem once a day. That's all just ahead on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.